It is 50-50 football on a Thursday/Friday. I mean, I don't know when you listen to it. I can't control that. We're recording it on a Thursday. It'll be out Thursday evening. Then we have our Monday one, which flips around the other way, where we talk about the weekend's football that has happened. But this is the preview. Neil Atkinson here with me. I've got Rob Gutman, Mo Stewart and Rebecca Knight. Over the phone, we will be joined by Tom Thrower from Bear Pit TV, David Mooney from the Blue Moon Podcast, Hayley McQueen to talk about what I call the Hayley McQueen Derby, and Robbie Scotcher on Crystal Palace. So it's quite the busy show. But we'll start with Stoke and Chelsea because Rebecca's come to be part of this show, which I made up about in person. And Rebecca, between injury and incompetence, I'm talking about Harry Kane and City dropping points at home against Stoke. It's no longer a game which feels as though Chelsea could just do with definitely making sure of the 3 points. Instead, it feels like one where if Chelsea did drop two, it wouldn't be the end of the world.
Yeah, definitely. It's quite a strange, I think, procession to the title. That's the only thing I can think to call it, to be honest. It's basically been the case that we're champions elect, and I've kind of thought this has been the situation for a couple of months now. Now, I know Conte obviously said when Chelsea were 8 points clear, this doesn't mean we're winning the league. It's not necessarily a done deal. It's a dangerous amount. It's not 2-0 is a dangerous scoreline. 8 points clear is great in January. Obviously, that's kind of got even better. And yeah, I mean, I've said it basically every time I've spoken to yourselves. It is the other teams dropping points that make Chelsea kind of feel, well, it doesn't really matter. When we played Arsenal and Liverpool in a week, I thought, does it matter if we drop points? No.
Do you think it helps? Well, I was going to say on that, do you think it almost, it's now, I mean, these things, they can sort of clatter into each other. So firstly, now the next part of this becomes, well, we're so far clear, everyone else does look like they're going to drop points. It actually means the players can play with a certain amount of relaxation. And that's one of the things I've seen from Chelsea all season. Almost every time I've watched them, I've thought, they don't half look like they're just relaxed and enjoying the football. They haven't, for a side who are top, you know, they haven't had the weight of the world on the shoulders. There was only really that situation around Christmas with Spurs where it did look like it was really hard. Apart from that, you feel as though Chelsea have just got themselves into this quite nice, calm, mental space where, well, it almost doesn't matter what we do, so we might as well just win anyway.
Yeah, I think, interestingly enough, what does help the players is if you're a player and you know you will be playing every single week, come hell or high water, you do relax. You don't think. Batshuayi, for example, is case in point. When we've seen Batshuayi in the FA Cup, he's got a couple of goals, but he has missed so many chances because he's taken a touch too early. He's shot too early because he's thinking, I have to show Conte I should be in this team. But week in, week out, Conte has rarely rotated those players through either not having players he trusts or just having fewer games, etc., etc. So those players have gone out there thinking, I can just play my football. This doesn't have to come off. If this cross doesn't work, I can do it again next time. There's no pressure. And I think that has been a massive plus for the players as well. But yeah, for sure, the other team's incompetence and the fact that Chelsea don't seem to be playing teams bar Spurs and to an extent Liverpool, although we did catch you at quite a bad time when we played Liverpool. I think they're not playing anybody that's particularly attacking them where they need to be attacked to show their vulnerabilities. And you look at Spurs, and Spurs have got Chelsea down to a T now. They know exactly what to do. They're pressing intense style, attacking down the flanks, running at Gary Cahill. This is everything you need to do. If you look at Eden Hazard's performance in the Spurs game this season as well, it was quite woeful, to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to the extent of if you kick Hazard, he goes out the game, because that's very unfair. But Spurs have seemed to find a way where other teams don't, of quietening him down quite a lot, I think, which, again, you know, if you stop Hazard, you tend to stop a bit of Chelsea.
Next part of this is to look back at the game on Monday night, where it was relatively smooth in the end. Obviously, it doesn't help that they go down to 10 men. But United are a weird side. They've managed to weird themselves in such a strange way this season, in that they're unbeaten in the league for about six to 12 months and remain sixth. And there's no end to that in sight that I can see, really. But there is this, you know, Chelsea also made it look easy. It was a really, again, it was the performance of a really mature side, a side who were used to playing with each other, a side who knew how to effectively do the last 15 minutes of that game. Yes, they should have made it 2-0, but when they hadn't, they had a clear path towards, right, this is how we get out of this 1-0, without really, relatively unscathed.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolute irony beating Jose Mourinho at Stamford Bridge 1-0, isn't it? I think that must have added absolute insult to injury, and with a goal from N'Golo Kante as well, who only seems to score against Man United. But yeah, United as a team are very strange. I mean, I look at Mourinho and I think I would consider myself somebody who knows Mourinho teams inside out. I've not missed a game through Inter, through Real Madrid, Chelsea, both spells. You know, this Man United side I look at and I think, I don't know what's going on. I can't predict what they're going to do. Whether it's they don't have the players that he wants to play the way he wants or whatever it is, I'm not quite sure. Because if you look at Mourinho's teams kind of throughout the years, they've always relied on a spine, without a doubt. Inter, Real Madrid, Porto, always a spine. So you look at Man United, you've got De Gea and you've got Ibrahimovic. That's your absolute spine. Mourinho seems to think Marcus Rocco is his defensive linchpin, or Eric Bailly almost certainly going forward will be that player. In the midfield, who do you have? Is it Herrera? Because bar the Chelsea game, Herrera's been excellent this season, without a doubt. I think Herrera is a player that's always on your starting lineup, but he's not going to be your Essien, your Makélélé, your Xabi Alonso. Yeah. So was Pogba supposed to be this player? I think he was. Now, Pogba and accommodating Pogba, I think, is a huge problem for Man United. And I think that is why they are weird.
It's the biggest problem they've got, to be brutally honest with you. I think anyone who watched that game could have said that he should have been the one to be substituted long before, but he hasn't. And I think he's only been substituted once in his entire Man United career. And if you consider some of the shoddy performances he's put in over that time, you'd think that he should have been substituted at least more than once.
Yeah, it's like they talk about the price tag, don't they? But even take away 89 million, take away what Pogba cost, pretend he's 5 million or pretend he's free, the academy, whatever. Look at him purely on his performances. Is this a player that should be in that starting 11? Because for me, the answer is unequivocally no.
I think it's killing them.
He's a bit anachronistic for me, Pop. I watched him very closely in that game. He doesn't work hard enough. He's almost like an 80s, you know, he's like a very much more athletic Charlie Adam. There's so much to his game, but the work rate's not there. Jesus Christ, you wouldn't last 2 minutes in that Monaco side we all watched last night.
He's a very, very, very good player, but he needs the rest of the team to be functioning perfectly to get him at his best. If you look back at that Juventus side, he had Pirlo and he had Vidal.
I have a big thing on this, and I think he'll be a lot better next season, Pogba, because my big thing on this is I actually don't think he's played that many games of football until this season, where when the going's got tough, he hasn't had the best players on the pitch on his side.
Yes.
And I think that changes, you know, if you're, and I think I expect him to step up. I think he'll be fine long term as a United signing. Exactly how, where he ends up playing, I'm not quite sure, but I think he'll be fine in terms of the fact that I think next season he'll learn from this, he'll improve, he'll work harder.
I think he'll be
harder.
There longer than Jose.
Yeah, but also I think his fitness will improve as well, because I think that's one of the other things, is he's come from Italian football, which is a little bit slower. And I just wonder if he's just going to have the year to settle. When you have that price tag, it's hard to have the year to settle. But I'm watching him thinking, you know, if you're looking around and you've got Marquezio, you're going to be all right. Yeah. I mean, I could probably function in the midfield with Marquezio for at least 10 minutes. Because I just think, you know what, if I'm having a rocky 10 minutes, I'll just pass it to Marquezio. Yeah. He'll always be in space. But Rob, I mean, he is a little bit of a throwback. He's a little bit difficult to accommodate tactically if you are Mourinho. You know, also, whilst they haven't quite got the wide player situation sorted, he can't go back to the 4-3-3 he first used when he was at Chelsea, where he might try to use him a little bit, sort of at the peak of that front three and sort of that midfield three. I think the whole thing's just, it just looks a little bit tricky, is sort of the beginning, middle and end of it, whilst the player's out of form.
Yes, he is a strange player. I mean, he's got the body shape of a classic number six, but he seems too attacking, so do you play him as an eight? But to me, and maybe this is just what I end up defaulting, when you know a player's good, but you can't see a position, you go, just stick him in the front three. There's a part of me that sees when he's at his best, Gerrardism's in him, and I think with the right movement around him, he could be devastating. And I feel that's where they'll eventually, one or two things will happen. He'll either do a Di Maria and they'll cut their losses on him sooner than we think. If he's to prevail, I think he'll end up in a front three with Mkhitaryan and another striker, and they'll have this powerhouse of a front three.
I think he'll end up roaming the midfield, definitely. I think, I have to say, Man United really annoyed me on Monday night, and partly because I'd expected more from them, but partly because they had the right game plan, but they just used the wrong people to do it. I mean, if you're going to have someone to man mark Eden Hazard, it can't be the most clumsy man in the whole of Manchester, Phil Jones. I don't think it could be Ander Herrera either, because he's been making a lot of tackles. You've got a guy sitting on the bench who was the man of the match in the World Cup final not long ago, and in a game where he shackled a lot of classic attacking midfielders in Schweinsteiger. I think this is would have been the perfect game to bring him in from the cold and say, look, you're only playing two more games for me. Make yourself a legend. Go out and win.
Has he got
game.
The legs, though, Mo?
Well, I think if you're going to play with a lot more people in midfield than the likes of Herrera, I think you can get away with him. You don't need him to run. Carrick doesn't have legs, but yet Carrick's always an effective player in that team. So he can be done. I think he would have been the one to do it. But
I think for me, I might have, and God, this is an unpopular opinion, and you know, rain the hate on me, I would have played Fellaini. And I would have had Fellaini follow him around like nobody's business. See, Fellaini lasts 60 minutes, gets his yellow card, winch him off, stick somebody like
he could have done the job as well.
Chop and change.
I think the only issue with Fellaini again is if he does get a yellow card early.
60 minutes, get him off. Yeah. But if you go back to Pogba, the one thing I would say is, for me, actually, he kind of reminds me of a Michael Essien in the way that he does bomb forward. I'm not sure whether he quite has the finishing ability of a Lampard or a Gerrard. I'm not sure whether we'll ever see that again from a midfielder. That was insane. And in Essien's first season in England, he was very, very hit and miss. Mm-hmm. And people looked at him and thought, nah, he isn't this player. He isn't what Mourinho needs him or wants him to be. And then he literally did end up being a box-to-box midfielder who would score. And I think Pogba may end up being that because he's got the physicality. He's got the legs. You know, another point that, touching on what Neil said, he hasn't actually had pre-season either.
No. Yep.
He hasn't had pre-season. So I think that's going to be a huge thing next season. There's no European football. It must have been a hangover for those French players as well, because I'm pretty sure they were, you know, we are going to win the Euros. This mm-hmm. is Portugal without Cristiano Ronaldo for quite a bit of the game. So I think that will have taken its toll on him as well.
Back to Chelsea then. The other thing to point out, slightly jealously, is the clean bill of health. That it's a remarkable run on injuries. And you're beginning to wonder whether or not you can draw a pattern on this. For instance, Leicester had a remarkable run on injuries last season. And whether or not it's, and I think it is, I think it is a double-edged sword. When you're playing really, really well, people don't want to be injured. So somehow they manage not to be injured. I think that's a massive part of it. No one gets an injured. Sides that are playing well often don't have injuries, and sides that don't have injuries are often playing well, if you know what I mean. And the players themselves maybe play through a couple of things they might not play through. If we're a bit in and out and we're sixth and it's a bit of a battle, boys, this week. And also they might be thinking themselves, well, I don't want to lose my place. But even with all that said, it has been a pretty remarkable continuous clean bill of health all season.
Yeah, I can't actually remember a season like it, mainly because I think I've always had a season of European football. And this year, for various reasons, has been very different. Chelsea also went out of the League Cup fairly early on. As we know, FA Cup only really kind of picks up in January anyway. So I think there's been less games, which has almost certainly helped the players. There's less travel as well. Mental fatigue hasn't hit the players, so that for me is as
and you get more
thing.
Mentally fatigued if you're losing as well. Yeah. So it's all interrelated.
Yeah, and if you're worrying about your place, then I think it's all, you know, I think of things like a pie chart almost. If you imagine a pie chart, Chelsea's pie chart this season has been close to perfect. No European football, no injuries, a strong 11, an 11 who know they're playing, a new manager, the boost from that. Other teams messing up. Everything has kind of fit together to form this pie chart mm-hmm. that is basically the pie chart of champions.
The next part of that as well is the other thing that, again, where I think once you get below number 14 in the squad, it's actually not great. It's actually really quite, it becomes quite weak quite fast, Rebecca. You're nodding at me there. 12, 13 and 14, though, are good players. Zouma looks, if anything, you feel a bit sorry for him. He could probably have done with more opportunities. He looks great whenever he gets 10 minutes.
He should have had them. I, for me, would have not axed Gary Cahill, but for me, Zouma is the long term. And also, if you look at the system Conte seems to deploy, Zouma in Europe, I would not panic if you had a Suarez running at him. Gary Cahill, I would be that GIF breathing out of a paper bag. I would be having a heart attack. So long term, I think
Ake did really well at Bournemouth, and again, he hasn't had a chance either.
Why have we brought him back? Why on earth have we brought him back?
I thought it was just mean.
Yes, if you... The most irate I would probably get when talking about Chelsea, and it's been years, and I try and calm myself, but is when you talk about the kids, because it frustrates me no end. And Ake, the minute we brought him back from Bournemouth, I said to my husband, the boy is never going to play. He'll play about 20 minutes. We are doing him a disservice. So what? He can sit from the bench. Is our bench that nice compared to Bournemouth?
I think it just showed Conte's ruthlessness, that. And you know what? I can only admire it in the sense that he just thought, I am taking no chances with this title. We're winning this. And for the sake of that lad's development, I couldn't give a fuck. If Cahill goes down and goes out with an ACL and the other somebody else pulls a hamstring, we're in the shit here. I want him here. And if he doesn't play a minute, tough shit. I think that was his thinking.
The only thing I can think of is that he's brought him into the group to get him ready for next season. Because I think as good as Chelsea have played so far, I think you look at that defence, like you say, Cahill. I think even Victor Moses, who's he's going to be injured for this game, I think. You can't see them going forward in a Champions League campaign and playing all before them. They're going to need reinforcements. And the way that Conte likes, he needs to know that his players are ready and able to fit every single word of his instructions. So bringing him into the squad, making him go through training, making him ready for next season. If that's what he's saying to him, I can understand it a bit. I still think that he'd been better off at Bournemouth.
I still think it was mean. Also,
Bournemouth was mean.
They were having a lovely time with him at centre-half, and he was playing so well for them. One more little thing with you, Rebecca, before we go and speak to Tom at Bear Pit TV, is the goalkeeper. It's not been discussed very much, but again, when you're also talking about stability, security, reliability, he's very much embodied that this season. I can't remember him making many great saves off the top of my head, partially because he hasn't had to, but also partially because his positioning so strong, he's 6'6". All of that sort of thing works for him. And people are rightly talking about Conte, Costa, Hazard. We're talking about those players. But when we're talking about stability, the fact that everyone on the pitch knows, broadly speaking, we've got the best goalkeeper in the league in the goal. I think he is. You're pulling a face like you don't. I think he is the best. I think he is one of the best goalkeepers in the league. By all means, disagree with me. You don't think he is?
I think he's one of the best goalkeepers in the league for sure. For me, De Gea is the better goalkeeper. And I should have
saved that on Monday night, you know.
Always. Well,
I should have saved that. No, I'm quite annoyed about that.
Yeah,
that,
you should.
From a Liverpool point of view, if that's Simon Mignola who lets that in, even after having made all the good saves, I've got to peel Gutman off the ceiling. Yeah. In all seriousness. He really should save that on Monday night.
No, I do agree. And Courtois also made a couple of big saves that night. When it comes to Courtois, will he stay, will he go? I think last season proved that Courtois cares about Courtois and nobody else. He has no loyalty to Chelsea, hasn't come through the academy. Football is a business to him. So in terms of his love for the club, there is none. Unfortunately, this is life. He has a wife and child who still live in Madrid, which is another thing that I think is a huge factor. From what I can gather, he isn't Real Madrid's first choice. He is their backup choice. But I don't think De Gea's going anywhere. I think De Gea, once the white suit and sitting in his girlfriend's house failed last season, kind of thought, nah, I'm going to stay with Man United. And I think, for me, that's what he's going to do. So when we look at Courtois, I think if you look at other clubs in the league, right, so there are five goalkeepers for me in the world that are the top level, and you're not getting any better than them. Now, you look at Manuel Neuer, he ain't going anywhere. You look at David De Gea, he ain't going anywhere. Buffon, not going anywhere. I would go now with Jan Oblak. He, for me, is so underrated because he plays for Atleti, who are so underrated, and people, they're not trendy, so people don't watch them. People don't know how good Oblak is. In the air, coming for crosses, penalty saves, shot reaction, the guy is great. Mm. So if Courtois did theoretically leave for Real Madrid, Courtois is, for me, the other guy I would put in that list, obviously. If Courtois did leave, we would hopefully move for Oblak and get him because money, Atleti, it's one of those things. But it's like Pep Guardiola has found out. It's what Liverpool are finding out or have found out. Once you get past those five people, you're struggling to get a world-class goalkeeper. You're on your Joe Harts, you're on your Begoviches, you're on your Carrioses and Mignolets, and these are, or your Keylor Navases. These are goalkeepers that are going to be making a couple of mistakes. Yeah, they'll make a good save. Yeah, they're solid. But if you want to be world-class, you've got to have one of them five.
I think we'd be better off just buying Atletico Madrid's goalkeeping coach, surely. I mean, he's had all of them. He's had De Gea, he's had Courtois, he's had Oblak.
And their forward coach, we'll have them as well. Yeah.
You're an expert on keepers, it seems. So what about this lad in Italy that we've been linked with him called Donnarumma or something like that?
He's so, so good, and he is such a huge prospect. But he's bizarrely been coming in for like a little bit of criticism. But it's ridiculous. The kid's 18 for a start. He's not going to hit his peak for another seven years, which is insane. I don't know whether he'd actually leave Italy. He's been linked quite heavily with Juve. Maybe he is Buffon's successor. Yeah. I could see that being the case. And then, you know, your progression in terms of national side and all these things. I think that is pretty much a prophecy that will be fulfilled for me.
Okay, we'll talk about the game of the weekend, Chelsea versus Stoke, in a minute. But before then, I've got Bear Pit TV. Joined now by Tom Thrower from Bear Pit TV to have a chat about Stoke and how the season's gone for them, really, in the context of this match with Chelsea at the weekend, but also the last sort of few weeks. And it's a funny place, Tom, that the season's ended up in, and I think it's sort of ended up in the place where Stoke supporters didn't want it to, but simultaneously there's not the jeopardy that other sides are struggling from at the minute. I mean, it's another solid season when I think maybe you were hoping for something a little more. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much spot on. We seem to have a squad in the summer that looked like it could go on and push on a bit how Everton have done. But realistically, it's just been another season of stability and finishing ninth, it looks like it's going to be.
You mentioned Everton there. That's quite an interesting comparison. Is it in the same way that, you know, every side sort of up and down the division as a team they want to match or surpass? Would it be fair to describe Everton as the side for you? You know, if you feel as though if you were finishing ahead of the Blues, you would be having a good season.
Yeah. Teams like Everton and Southampton, who've probably underperformed this season, but they're sort of who we compare ourselves with, and not just in terms of performance, but in terms of sort of, we're trying to get into youth recruitment and we're trying to bring young players through the squad, and that's two things that Southampton and Everton have done well as finishing in those sometimes European places. So yeah, finishing above Everton or Southampton is what the aim would have been at the start of the season.
Is there, from there, before we get on to specifically the weekend's game, you know, is there therefore something in terms of, when you talk about sort of recruitment, both developing youngsters and recruitment, it feels like Stoke, there's a lot of gambles are taken, you know, right the way through all the time. That feels as though that's where what you've got to do and how it's got to work. For instance, Boney's a gamble, Berahino is a gamble, Bojan was a gamble, Shaqiri's a gamble, Afellay was a bit of a gamble. You know, it's a lot of players who've had a go at a club which would perhaps expect to be in the Champions League or something like that. I know when I was sort of trying to find the level, and it's difficult, isn't it, from your point of view, from a Stoke point of view, because you're sort of trying to find yours at the same time. Do you know what I mean? Am I making sense to you?
Yeah, I think I understand what you mean. And it's something we've had sort of, even since we first got promoted, we were picking up players who tried to be at the top of the Premier League and had struggled with that. So your Jermaine Pennant, your Matty Etherington. And it's really strange, especially with, you mentioned Shaqiri. It's been weird with Stoke fans this season because quite a lot are getting increasingly frustrated at how much time he's spending out with an injury. But then the other half are arguing, well, that's the thing we've got to take with Shaqiri, because if you don't have that, he's going to be playing at one of the top clubs. He wouldn't be at Stoke.
When you say that people are getting frustrated both with the players, and also at times it's felt this season with the manager, it's a difficult job for him. He himself is someone else who's, you know, he was at Manchester City, for instance. He's got his terrific career. Is there something for him in terms of the fact that, again, people want just a little bit more? Is he coming under any pressure about that, or is it just more that sort of a general feeling of slight, almost slightly intangible disappointment?
It's probably a bit more of the latter, but Hughes has almost brought it on himself a bit more this year. Because his main remit when he was brought in was to bring a bit more of an entertaining style of football. And this season, you can definitely point out and say that he's moved away from that. He's moved to domestic players who he can rely on, who maybe play sort of longer balls than it is in his nice-looking football. And it hasn't brought the success with it. So that's where the fans have started to get frustrated with the manager.
Yeah, I think that's what's been coming through, really. I mean, there was a couple of results earlier in the season where you felt as though people were really heads were really going. Obviously, the defeat at home to Wolves was one. There was the defeat at home to Leicester, which also drove people mad. The 2-2 against Leicester wasn't a defeat, and it just felt like one to everybody, having been 2-0 up and they were down to 10 men. You know, it seemed as though there's just these patterns, isn't there, where he's, as you say, he either his side are bringing it on him or he's bringing it on himself, that the people are struggling a little bit with what he's serving up.
Yeah, and we haven't this season had the great wins like beating Man City or beating Man United at home to break that up. We haven't been a team in the top 10 this season. So it really does sort of feel like we've really been put in our place and we're just a mid-table team who will beat the bottom half, but then can't compete with the top half at the minute. And that's where the frustration boils through, because at times, especially against the better sides, we haven't even looked like we're trying to compete with them. We've just been totally outdone by them most times.
So with an eye on the weekend then, coming up against Chelsea, it's obviously, you know, we're talking about the side at the top, not just in the top 10, and, you know, having not beaten the side in the top 10 all season. What do you want to see from this Stoke side? Not even the idea of what is he going to do or how is it going to play out. What do you want to see from Hughes' men this weekend?
The last match against Man City was something that I think every fan was happy with, because the team worked hard as a unit and Hughes had picked a tactic, clearly, to go to Man City and to make sure that not that just we didn't get beat, but that we posed Man City threats as well. Because I think at times we've come up against the big teams, and especially against Tottenham in both of the defeats against them, we've almost offered nothing going forward. So, of course, we're going to get spanked to invite it on ourselves. So I'd say the thing that everyone for is just to have like a counter-attacking plan and to pose some threats to Chelsea. Obviously, they're going to be dominant in the game, we expect. But just to try and, outside of that dominance, get at their defence, try and score some goals.
And also, you're at home, and I think that's the other thing, that's, you know, you put a performance on at home and getting the crowd going, because I've noticed this season from the games I've seen, I've been to Stoke yet this season going on the 8th, but I've noticed that, you know, what's come through on the telly is that crowd's a little quieter than it used to be one way or another. It's not felt quite felt like the Bear Pit atmosphere that, you know, you call Bear Pit TV after, you know. I've been to some games at Stoke, and it's, you know, it's an exceptionally aggressive crowd, and I think, you know, if they can act in a way which gets everyone going early, then they can make it harder and harder for Chelsea.
Yeah, I think against the bigger side, that raucous atmosphere has been there. It was there against United when we held them to a goalless draw, to a 1-1 draw even. But yeah, and I think it's gone away because of the expectancy. It's gone away because we come up against teams like Bournemouth or Watford or Swansea, and the expectancy is that we will beat them. So the fans don't feel as if they need to play a role in that as much as we used to. And that's probably where the atmosphere's gone. But yeah, against Chelsea, it will be important for the fans to really get behind the team and make that horrible atmosphere that people don't like playing in.
Okay. Thank you very much. Want to give me a quick prediction?
I don't know why, but I think quite a few of the Stoke fans are feeling this. We might just sneak it 2-1 or something.
You did all right at the Bridge.
Yeah, we did. We did well, sort of, for parts of the game, and then just totally let ourselves down. So, I don't know. I feel Chelsea, there's a weakness there. No one's found it yet, but they don't quite look now like they looked sort of 2 months ago. They don't look that unbeatable.
Okay, excellent. Sneaking it 2-1 for Stoke. Let's get back and see what everybody else thinks. Stoke on outside, Rob, you watched them against Spurs. They got beat 4-0. They're capable of getting beat 4-0 at any given moment, seemingly. They haven't beaten a single side in the top 10 this season. A few draws in there. But they're also, and have been, historically capable of upsetting apple carts at home. They're just in a strange place as a football club, really. They're sort of dealing with their ninth place reality to a certain extent. It's not necessarily a bad thing, but it doesn't lead to many adventures.
No, You could say they haven't pushed on from a good finish last season, but then again, they haven't gone backwards either, because they've not, apart, I think they had a slightly dodgy start to the season, but they've never really looked relegation fodder at all. It was their party piece to go and beat one of the top six, though, wasn't it? That was the thing, I think, that kept their seasons alive. Their fans would, I think, last season, what, Shaqiri bangs a couple in, is it against Arsenal habitually?
A big Saturday morning kickoffs against United, being 3-0 up before United know where they are, and that
yes,
sort of stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. But I don't know, we were talking about this game the other day, you and I, Neil, and I said, This is either the routine 4-0 for Chelsea, or Stoke do get something here. You don't see much in between, like a 1-0 for there is a good Stoke in there somewhere, is what I'm struggling to say. And whether it'll serve us or not, I don't know.
They like Chelsea, though. I mean, the last few times I've seen them play against Chelsea, they've always seemed to perform
very
well.
Did all right at Stamford Bridge.
Yeah, they did all right at Stamford Bridge. And I remember a couple of seasons before with the Charlie Allen halfway line spectacular. So, sorry to bring that up again. But I think...
I'm furious about that, you know, Mark. On a personal level. Go on.
One of the things that you were talking about earlier, Rebecca, is that teams don't know how to attack Chelsea. And I think that Stoke have the weapons. I mean, John Walters, everybody's favourite. I think he's going to be coming back into the side. I think one of the things that I seem to remember the Stoke players talking about was trying to get him up against Azpilicueta. Because Azpilicueta's not that great in the air.
There's going to be loads of back post balls from Stoke.
Yeah,
when they get down and play, they're going to be slinging them in back post.
He's going to be a doubt, you know.
Exactly, which makes Walters' position even more important, because if they're going to have him there trying to play up against Azpilicueta, they're going to need someone quicker, shorter. So maybe Berahino, if you've not got Arnautović or Shaqiri around.
Afellay maybe might use in wide areas.
He's just come back into a form. So they've got the weapons and they've got the home crowds. Whether or not they can capitalise on the fact that we've all said that if Chelsea go 1-0 down at half-time, is it going to be just pride that brings them back into it, or are they going to be like, okay, we'll write this one off?
My Stoke question is actually whether or not they've got the 90 minutes, Rebecca, because what you've seen this season from Chelsea is lots of very good 90-minute performances. Don't knock off, even if it's not going so well. Nice little patterns of play to get us through 5 minutes, and you never know, it might improve in a minute. And a lot of that sort of football, and that's my thing, that's why I think Chelsea will actually win the game at the weekend, is because I think that Stoke will huff and puff and they'll have a couple of very good spells, but Chelsea will navigate through that, come out the other side, I think, and then when they need to, they can put the foot down and have a very good 15 minutes of their own.
I mean, it's funny that you mentioned pride, because last season, I don't know who stole Chelsea's pride, but it just wasn't there. Yeah. You know, nobody seemed to care whether we won or lost. It was insane. You know, I was absolutely distraught. I'd spent £70 on my shirt proudly displaying champions on the back. By September, couldn't wear that out the house, could I? So, you know, would like a refund. But the pride this season is there, and they do dig in, and it's this mental attitude, which, again, you have to question these players, because it's not like they don't have this mental attitude. They've chosen not to use it. But it's back. Conte's here. Everything's great until they fall out with him. But against Stoke, I would say Chelsea will win the game. And quite frankly, and it sounds absolutely terrible to be able to say it, but do we care if we don't? Like... Is it going to make a difference? It'd be funny for the papers, but for Chelsea fans, we're still winning the league,
I mean,
which is horrible.
As long as there's not a key injury or a red card, after we've spoken all this about all the injury stuff.
Seems as hard out for 6 months.
No, I mean, that's the only thing that I think would make a difference at this stage, even if Chelsea lost the weekend. Looking at the games they've got left, there's more than enough winnable fixtures to see them get over the line on 86, 87 points. And it doesn't, you know, apart from possibly Manchester City, you're not looking at anyone else thinking they can put a run together.
And even City.
No.
And even City. They've got to play Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea back to back.
Yep.
I mean, if they get one bad result, if they get two bad results out of that, kiss their season goodbye.
Yeah, I agree with that, apart from the top four, the fight for top four. And they crashed out of Europe, Manchester City. Very quickly, I'll do the other Chelsea-Stoke predictions. Rob?
1-0 to Stoke.
1-0 Stoke, good Lord. Mo?
2-1 Chelsea, unfortunately.
Okay.
Rebecca.
I think Rebecca's told me that she thinks they're going to win.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I want a precise score.
3-1 Chelsea.
Okay.
3-1 Chelsea.
Shut up now.
City crashed out of Europe. That appears to be the only way you can leave a cup competition these days, is by crashing out. I've got a bit of a bee in my bonnet about this. I actually get into it with David Mooney, and that I think that Man City got beat over two legs by a really good, exciting side. And that's all right. It's a thing that happens, Mo, in football. Sometimes you're going to get beat by a really good, exciting side. They've scored the most goals of any side in Europe in the top flight. They've scored all different types of goals. Man City don't defend well. In general, they don't defend well. But the idea anyway that practically anyone could go into the game against Monaco thinking we'll just shut up shop and get off the other side is ridiculous. And yet, after the fact, that's what everyone says. Or why didn't they just try and shut the game down? And it's just been a bit mad to me. It's like we've got to stick the boot in.
I think, to be honest, one of the things that I don't pay a lot of attention to what managers say in post-games, because a lot of the time they're not really put their thoughts together. But one thing that Guardiola said really stuck in my mind. He said, I couldn't convince them to attack in the first half. Now, He literally, at first minute, I thought maybe it's the whole, his English isn't his first language, he didn't understand. He's been speaking English for a long time. I think he knew exactly what he meant. And that is a damning indictment. Because what that says to me is that the players did not trust their own defence. So they're thinking, okay, we can't just sit back and defend. So we're going to need to do something else.
We're going to need to do it in numbers instead of leading to that. I thought it was really striking that, Robert, in terms... And the Man City manager beforehand... And John Stones said a post-match, John Stones said we didn't attack well enough when everyone wanted them to talk about the defending. And then it becomes... Well, that becomes a John Stones thing, which, again, I think is unfair. I think the idea that City have made some sort of profound error, I just don't quite buy it.
No, they couldn't get out. I mean, they reminded me... They reminded me of the City that we tore apart at the Etihad about a year and a half ago, in Jurgen Klopp, one of his first games, where, you know, they had all the tools in the box, but our sheer aggression, attitude, running, will to win made them look hapless. And Monaco's performance reminded us of our performance in that first half. I think we were 3 up at half-time, something like that.
Mm-hmm. 3-1 at half-time.
Yeah, 3-1, yes, because Aguero scores just before the break. Monaco was sensational. Yeah, absolutely sensational. But you did feel City weren't helping themselves by offering no threat coming the other way. To reiterate what Mo said, it looked for all the money in the world that Monaco had to run themselves out as well. That you know, I was on Twitter myself going, what are they on? Mm-hmm. Literally, that was as hyped up and aggressive as I've seen a side. That made you know, sort of...
But they did fall off a cliff.
Oh, they do fall off a cliff. And in a way, City should have composed themselves. You don't think mentally, forget everything, City lost their heads there. They looked shell-shocked.
There's something interesting, I think, in European football at the moment, Rebecca, when we end up doing all the Premier League navel gaze and stuff. And it's that there's either sides that have got elite forwards, and by elite, I mean the very, very best forwards. I mean, like Barcelona, like Madrid, to a certain extent by Munich. There's the sides who've got genuinely astonishing elite forwards. And then there's the sides who have had to learn how to cope against genuinely astonishing elite forwards. And one of my things is, and I use Atletico Madrid in this because I think they're a really interesting example. Atletico Madrid get effectively 4 practice goals a season in the league at being against the very best forwards in the world. The very best football, two of the best players who've ever lived, possibly 6 of the best players who've ever lived, is what they come up against. Ah, that's fine.
I hope Benzema's not in that.
Well, maybe. but they come up against some of the most astonishing football. They have to work out how to do it. They have to work out how to defend against it. Whereas, so you can be Atletico Madrid and you can say, we're going to shut up, we're going to be defensive. And this is, we know how to do this because we have to do it. 4 times a season, we have to try to do it. We get to practice it. Whereas... suddenly City are coming up against the sort of class of forward in that Monaco side who they'll get every now and again. They'll get when they face Chelsea, to a certain extent when they face Spurs with Kane, but he's a different type of player. It's the ability to move the ball at such pace. And so I think when we try to sort of go, well, he should just know how to shut up shop and do all this sort of stuff, well, they just don't have to do it very often is my point. They tend to be the side with the elite forwards when they're playing in the English league.
Yeah, I would take that to a certain extent. I mean, one of the things I would say about Monaco as well is they kind of have the Atleti syndrome around them. So when Atleti have, you know, got to 2 finals in 3 years, and when English sides have talked about them, it's almost like in England, people can't see past the Premier League. If you're in Spain, Italy, Germany, France, you're not a good side. So people have heard Monaco...
Unless you're Real Madrid or Barcelona.
Yeah, people have heard Monaco and thought, Man City are going to walk this. They've not even looked at Ligue 1 to see how well Monaco are doing. They've not looked to see Monaco have got the new Thierry Henry, or they've not looked to see Monaco have got X amount of players who
or score more goals than anyone else.
Too. Yeah, they've not looked to see about their coach. They've not looked at their tactics, how free-flowing their football is. They've not thought, actually, this is a very bad draw for Man City, because Man City are not good when they are attacked, and Monaco were always going to attack them. Also, going over there, in terms of distance, it's nothing, but their stadium is very small, very compact. The fans are very on it. It's a very kind of strong atmosphere. Mm. Even though there's not that many in the stadium. But in terms of having to play these elite sides and whatnot, yeah, I do agree with that. But I also massively subscribe to the theory that if you're in Europe and you've scored 6 goals, you have done something extremely wrong not to have gone through.
Yeah.
PSG, exactly the same. So you, at some point, have to look at yourself and hold yourselves accountable.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. But then the converse of that is that, for instance, if the goals have just been scored the other way around in the fixtures, then... Monaco would be in a position where they hadn't have gone through, if you know what I mean. That sometimes you can just have two good sides.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And undoubtedly, that's what they were. But Guardiola's also a manager that's had to play, you know,
yep.
against Real Madrid yep. and against Athletic. Guardiola's been around the Champions League for a very long time. So what is it saying if you're saying he can't get his players to either attack or set up to defend? That's a flaw as a coach.
Very much so. I also think that if it had been reversed and Monaco had gone into their home second leg with a two-goal lead, or even their away leg with a two-goal lead, they'd have gone out and attacked. They'd have known exactly what got them there and they'd have kept doing it. Maybe that fearlessness
yeah,
of youth.
I agree with that.
Perhaps, I don't know.
No, I think it's knowing what's brought you to the party. And I agree with that. I think that that's absolutely spot on. They would have gotten attacked. If they'd have been 3-1 up from the first leg going to the Etihad, they'd have spent the entirety of the first half of the game thinking, if we score three goals, we'll go through.
I mean, the most damning indictment about what you were saying before about the way the people disregarded Monaco is they did it to Arsenal 2 years ago. They literally did the same thing to Arsenal 2 years ago, and everyone seems to have forgotten
and
that.
And Spurs in the group stage, didn't they?
And Spurs in the group stage as well. They won.
They're a good side. I mean, this is the thing around, you know, whilst there's the very best, and everyone's talking about the number of quarterfinalists, that it's only been five since 2011, and it's been, before then, it was 17 quarterfinalists in the six-year period, Rob. Leicester get the results.
Yeah.
Arsenal managed to be Arsenal. And
they do get Bayern Munich again.
They do get Bayern Munich again, but they're still very Arsenal about the entire enterprise.
Absolutely.
But they also forget that. One of the other things as well is to notice when you're talking about the quarterfinalists, well, one of the issues is that an English side tends not to be getting through the group, partially because of seeding, partially through not being quite good enough. It's this imperfect circle, really, while simultaneously Arsenal are created to literally finish in the top four. The entire conceit of Arsenal is to finish in the top four. It's not to actually build a side that can get to the last eight or last four of the Champions League, whereas you do feel as though if you'd have got, say, what we've seen from Chelsea, Liverpool, and to a certain extent United this season, if they'd have actually been in the Champions League, it wouldn't surprise me if at least two of those three would have found themselves in the last eight by hook or by crook, playing all quite different types of football.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, that. I mean, Liverpool showed in the Europa last season that they had a European game back.
And the records against the other sides in the top six this season domestically,
yeah,
for Liverpool.
Exactly. So you wonder, and I hope it augurs well for Liverpool, and we're in the Champions League next season, whether we can have something special about us in Europe the way we do, in a different way to how we do under Rafa Benitez. United, again, they've got that Mourinho defensive solidity, which means they'll keep themselves in ties, and that's what Rafa did so often for Liverpool. So I think that's a fair shout. And Conte's Chelsea, you can't see them being anything other than highly productive in Europe. So City, you wonder how long City will struggle for as a European team. It's beginning to. I don't know. It's going to become a major psychological problem for them, I think culturally, as a football team.
For them, they've got to get the recruitment right. They've got to get the right players in, because something else I heard today, they were looking at maybe 18 players coming out of that squad. Now, that's a lot of players, but when you look down the list...
They've got six or seven out of contract.
Yeah, they have, and they've got another five out on loan. So when you look down the list of players, it's only really Aguero, Kompany, of the ones who you... sorry, Yaya Toure, are the ones who you'd think that they might want to keep who are on that list. So that means that they've got a whole lot of work to do.
Yeah, I mean, both all the fullbacks are either out of contract or have been strongly linked away. There's practically all the defenders apart from Stones. If you actually then move into midfield, Torre's contract is up. You keep moving forward. Navas, I think his deal runs out at the end of the season, and Lito's not been a success. Simultaneously, they're playing some really good football and they're exciting, yep. Manchester City. And I spoke to David Mooney about both Europe before and Manchester City themselves. And this is what David had to say from the Blue Moon podcast. From the Blue Moon podcast, David Mooney, to talk about Manchester City. And I'm gonna stick my neck on the line here, David, and I'm going to be the person who says it. I think Manchester City were unlucky. I think that everyone's doing the you should defend better, but no one scored more goals in the entirety of top-flight European football this season than Monaco. There's the idea of, well, you know what, either find a way to shut up shop or something like that. Well, again, as part of that, the manager said before, and that they'd have to score. If you want to talk about the players, you know, talk about the fact that that's the manager's approach, but also the manager knows the terrain, knows what it's about. And also, City had a ton of chances. This is a good Manchester City side that's been a little bit unfortunate across the two legs and come up against a side that looks banging form on the one hand, has got tons and tons of energy on the other, and who rode the luck a little bit at the end of both of these legs. And I don't think we necessarily need the Grand Inquisition, but you might disagree with me.
No, I actually think that's a fair assessment. I've got a bit of a thing with City in the Champions League, where for certainly since when they qualified in 2011, I'll give you a quick history lesson there. When they first qualified for the Champions League in 2011-12, they were very unlucky to go out of the group that they were drawn into. They got 10 points from a group with Napoli, Villarreal and Bayern Munich, and they finished third in that group. And it was one of the, I think 10 points that season would have seen them qualify from every other group apart from that one. So it just showed it was a competitive group. And they kind of took that one on the chin and went, yeah, you know what, it shows we can compete at this level. And then for the next kind of two or three seasons, they started making excuses for themselves and they started not taking responsibility for what was going on. The final year under Mancini was a disaster. They're the only English team never to win a group game in the six games that season. The following season, the Pellegrini, they stormed the group and then went out to Barcelona after putting up a good fight at home for a few minutes, for kind of a good kind of a good hour or so, but a bad decision on Di Michaelis being he was rightfully sent off, but the foul was outside the box and okay. Messi took the penalty and scored. And ever since then, every time City have had a bit of bad luck in the Champions League, it's almost as if they put hands up and gone, you know what, we can't do anything about this.
Yeah.
So we've been really unlucky. Oh, woe is us, sort of thing. And I actually got the impression that against Monaco, that had gone. As much as the bad luck was there, I still feel like City were kind of ready to dust themselves down and go again. They were absolutely woeful in that first half. And that's down to how, I think, partly down to how City set up, but partly down to how Monaco started the game. They had to attack City because they needed two goals. I just think at least there are signs that they're not feeling sorry for themselves anymore. And that, I mean, they were unlucky against to go out on Wednesday, but it's they've scored six goals and conceded six against a team that's been banging in three or four most games anyway. So it's as much as City's defensive problems have been there, and they have been there all season. I thought they did as well as they probably could defensively, and it kind of falls to maybe if they'd taken one more chance, things would have been different.
I think all that's fair. One of the things that struck me was at 3-1, I just thought City looked like a side whose legs had gone. Not like a side who couldn't make it happen, but because of a psychological issue, it just looked to me like the legs had gone. Like it was all very, very hard all of a sudden. And I've seen that, I've seen that right the way down the years, that, it's tough to drag yourself back into a game, to work that dead hard. And if anything, have to work too hard to get the goal and then see that, it gets chalked off quite so quickly and that you need to go again. That's where I think it is tough. It's tough at every level of football. And I agree with you in terms of the fact that in the past, City have looked like the competition sort of not for them and it's all a bit difficult. Whereas against Monaco, it just looked as though it was a normal football outcome, if you sort of know what I mean.
Yeah, it was. They lost, but it was kind of one of those where you just put your hands up and go, oh, well, it was, we tried, we failed. If we played it again, then, we'll have a damn good go at it again. And in the past, you kind of feel like City had come away from that going, well, the referee made a bad case. I actually feel City should have had a penalty when Aguero went through one-on-one. But you don't see the players kind of going, well, we had that bit of bad luck when we didn't get the decision or this and that, and kind of sulking for 20 minutes and thinking things weren't going their way, and then eventually, leaving themselves too much to do. They at least had a go. They were terrible for about 50 minutes of the 90 on Wednesday, but at least they had a go while they were being terrible.
Lots of talk of the defensive frailties of Manchester City, which is striking as they hadn't conceded a goal on the road until last night for about six or seven games. Obviously concede three at home to a good Monaco side, concede to a Swansea City side in a strange game where City had dominated it. And going right the way back then, there's the strange back-to-back games against Everton, ship four away from home, and then the 2-2 against Spurs, where they've been the better side, but Spurs pull it round, and if it finishes 2-2 late on in the game. With an eye on the weekend's game against Liverpool, do you think the defensive frailties stuff is actually being slightly overstated, or do you think that the defensive frailties are best seen as if City come up against a side who can attack and attack well and attack at an elite top six sort of level, those frailties come sharply into focus? Whereas when they're playing a lot of the sides elsewhere in the division, the ability they've got on the ball, the amount of threat they carry, it just sort of keeps those sides away from City's defenders. How do you see that playing out?
You mentioned the away clean sheet record. The list of teams is Middlesbrough, Sunderland, Huddersfield, Bournemouth, West Ham. They're not the sides that you would expect to come to City or City to go to, and then they take the game there and scythe through them willy nilly. The games where City have struggled have been when the defence has been, I won't say put under pressure, because I think City cope well when teams try to press them. I think City generally do okay because they're quite good at getting the ball through the space and getting it onto the front foot to attack them. It's when there's a lot of pressure for a long time. I mean, Liverpool have traditionally kind of done this to City where they press and press and press and City just can't get out. That's the type of pressure that City struggle under. And, you know, we've hit a point in City's season where Alexander Kolarov is the best centre-half at the club. And that just that as a sentence should not make sense in any way, shape or form because he's by no means a great defender. He's at best competent. And you look at what City have invested in the defence over the last few years. They've wasted a lot of money on players who are very rash in their challenges. They're very loose positionally and just can't keep any kind of shape there. I actually think when it comes down to the biggest waste of money, I mean, you know, Mangala was a laughing stock for the time that he was at City. I actually think he's better than Otamendi. I think Otamendi is useless. And what teams have been doing is been able to target, you know, the weak links in the defence, and the City have needed new fullbacks for 3 years now. They've been able to target more than one player and just have a field day at times. And I actually feel a little bit sorry for John Stones because he came in, did okay to start with, had a bit of a dip in form when, you know, the spotlight was on him. He was left out for a couple of games in December when Guardiola really kind of taken him out of the heat. And ever since he's come back, he's looked really solid and really kind of competent. And then looked to his left and he's seen, you know, two defenders that can't hold the position and put a tackle in. And looked to his right and seen a fullback that can't get up and down the line anymore. So he's kind of fighting a losing battle on his own. And so when teams are putting City under so much pressure, there's so many mistakes in the defence that they don't need to really work too hard to get the goals. And the reason City are out of the title race was that spell in the autumn where pretty much everything that was shot at the goal went in. And when you're in that situation, then there's big questions got to be asked about the back four. And I'll be absolutely astounded if City don't go into the transfer market big time in the summer about this, because they've thrown money at it so far and they've just... They've squandered it more than anything else. I think they were probably wrong to let Nastasic go. I think he was a good option that could have developed something quite well. Mangala's been a waste of time. Otamendi's been a waste of time. You know, Kompany's consistently injured, and Kolarov's a fullback. So it just that's the position City are in at the moment.
When you're going through all of that, that. Again, with partially a conversation around the Monaco game where if you can't rely on your defence, then the idea that you can go to somewhere like Monaco and shut up shop is ridiculous. If you don't feel as though you can rely on them, then that's the thing not to do. You've got to accentuate your strengths and not try to mitigate such a significant weakness. But also that reminds me of the Chelsea game, sorry, the Tottenham game, when I think this game at the weekend against Liverpool might end up following a similar pattern, which is that City might end up picking a very, what will look on paper and possibly be in practice, a very, very attacking lineup, partially to ensure that the ball is just simply up the other end of the pitch against a very, very good side. So football is in absolutely every position. Look to say, well, if we can't just shut you out anyway in any way, shape or form, we're just going to try and keep the ball as far away from our goal as possible. Is that how you see Guardiola going about this against Liverpool, thinking I've just got to have footballers absolutely everywhere?
I think that's the thing. His setup's quite odd, actually. One thing I've noticed through watching him manage at City this season, he's not afraid to leave his defenders one-on-one, which I think when you've got, you know, defenders like Bayern Munich and Barcelona had, you're probably all right doing that. But when you've got defenders like City have got currently, it causes problems. There's been so many times when he's quite happy to let strikers run at one of his defenders one-on-one because he puts the faith in the defender to either win the ball or do enough to kind of shepherd the chance out. And what that does is it leaves him free to pick mainly five attacking players and one kind of anchoring midfielder. And to an extent, that's worked for City in the last few weeks, mainly because of the pace that Sterling and Sane have had on the wings and the influence that either Jesus or Aguero's had in the middle to basically terrorise teams, keep the opposition defence spread and mean that their midfield generally sits a little bit deeper to kind of cover it. But when you're playing against teams like Bournemouth and Sunderland, who will be very wary of what City can do like that, they're likely to drop a bit deeper. And I just worry that City have got a run of fixtures coming up, Liverpool, then I think it's Arsenal, Chelsea. All three of those teams are going to go, all right then, let's see what you can do. We think we can get at you, so we're going to have a go at you. And I think I'm not entirely convinced that City's recent approach will be that successful in those games. I think we'll see a big difference with Toure coming back in. He was absolutely overrun in the first leg against Monaco, and I can see why Guardiola opted for Fernandinho in the middle on Wednesday night. But all that did was change the name of the player that was overrun in the middle. So it was, there's clearly some sort of issue there, rather than it just being a player that doesn't have the legs that Toure's not got anymore. So I wonder if he'll go back to something along the lines of Toure sitting with Fernandinho a little bit more box to box between him, and maybe sacrifice De Bruyne, because De Bruyne's been bang out of form in the last few weeks, and I think he does need a rest.
I mean, it'd be an interesting selection sort of headache for him, that, because the other option as well, he has been using Fernandinho in the fullback position to try to shore up there as well. So it feels at the minute like he's using Fernandinho to almost try to put out a couple of fires, and it might be whichever fire he feels is burning hottest this weekend.
There's so many fires on City's pitch. They need a fire brigade to sort this out. The only thing that City have got going for them at the moment is that their front three is absolutely dynamite, and David Silva behind them is playing some of the best football he's played in a long time. You know, you take that out of the equation, and City are... It's very hit and miss what happens elsewhere on the pitch. You know,
has Fernandinho gone off the boil? Because he started the season, when I was watching City at the start of the season, and I haven't seen, you know, he's obviously had suspensions, and the way games have kicked off has all become a little bit different. I saw he was struggling last night, but I put that as much down to Monaco and the setup. But in general, has he not quite kept his first half of the season form up?
I've never really thought about it. And now that you mention it, I think he's been used as a bit more of a utility man since he's come back from suspension. I think part of it is the return of Toure, because I don't think back in November when he apologised, I think even then, you know, most people expect him to play maybe one or two cup games and not have the impact he's had in the team. Toure's got himself into a position where in that kind of one in front of the back four and behind the kind of next four, he's made himself undroppable at the moment, because he's beyond, you know, having two games a week and needing to rest his legs, he's just been pulling the strings most games. And the way City have set up, it's not really left a place for Fernandinho to go in. So as you say, he's been ending up at left back, and he's been, you know, ending up on the left side of midfield to cover here or there. And I just wonder if that kind of utility man role has been diminishing what he can do across the pitch. I wouldn't say he's gone off the boil. I'd say he's not had as much influence in the last few weeks, probably down to that. And he's also not really played as much as he was earlier in the season. So I think that's a big factor on it. I think again, though, the fullback thing, it just goes to show how poor Clichy's been when a fit Gael Clichy's not knocking a central midfielder out of his own position. It just sums up where City are at the moment.
Quickly then, before we go back to everyone else, how do you see the game playing out? What's your prediction?
I honestly don't know, because I'm not sure what I make of. I've not seen a whole lot of Liverpool in the last few weeks, but I'm not really sure what I make of them. I can't particularly tell if they've come out of that real bad slump that they had for a few weeks. I would expect it to be a tight game, purely more than hope than anything else, because the last few times Liverpool have come to the Etihad, it's been quite an open game. I don't see City trying to defend, because they can't do it. They've got to try and keep the ball and attack Liverpool. I think that will play into what Liverpool want, so I can see a very open and attacking game from both teams. I see plenty of goals from both teams. Liverpool tend to have it quite easy against City, so I worry about it on that front. Let's go optimistic. Let's say a 3-2 City win, shall we? I'm not basing on anything more than blind luck and arrogance that my own team should do better because they're at home, sort of thing.
Okay, let's go back and see what everyone else thinks. David there. Now, Rebecca, I thought the game at Anfield on New Year's Eve would be a cracker, and it wasn't. It was intense, but I was expecting a five-goal thriller, hopefully with a Liverpool win from my point of view, but I thought it'd be a really good game, and then Liverpool ground out a 1-0, and that's what it became. Liverpool have excelled in these sorts of games this season, but you do wonder whether or not Manchester City, if they can come alive, can get playing. There, I think it's Manchester City who decide whether or not the game's a cracker, both with the strengths and the weaknesses.
Yeah, almost certainly. New Year's quite a special one for me anyway, because my husband is a Liverpool fan, but we actually got married on New Year's Eve.
Really?
Yeah.
Pre-kickoff?
So, actually, no. As everything was going on, actually, as that game was really quite boring, so nothing was so eventful when we were welcoming people, speaking to people. The 3 PMs came around, and my husband was doing a speech going on about blah, 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 how much he loves me and all this bollocks. And unfortunately, Man United were a goal down, and I love Jose. We were clearly winning the title. I wanted Man United to get in the top four, you know, checking their results. Anyway, they scored two really late goals, didn't they? And on the Pogba goal, I jumped up and started swearing, cheering, goodness, in the middle of my husband's speech. And there is video footage of this.
My Lord.
You can see his Auntie Jan's face like, what the fuck, is he married? But I think... In terms of Liverpool in big games, they are built for them, which is another reason why I also think they do so well in Europe. I mean, it is the lifting themselves up to this different thing and a completely different level. I think the fans help that for sure. That is one thing that really does make them a different prospect when you talk about playing against Chelsea's and Man United's and in cup ties especially. It's almost like Liverpool are a cup team and the top six are a cup team.
Yep.
For them, top six games and are like, one, like a cup.
We have that big advantage over City in particular because that's one thing they have struggled in some of their big European games is actually getting the crowd up for them. I mean, you're
what
saying...
crowd?
Well, exactly, the old empty head, as they call it. You were talking before about Monaco and about how they've got quite a small crowd. I think what really worked in their favour was the fact that they don't get a lot of crowds. So when they did all turn up and they were all fervent, the Monaco players were like, okay, we've got a crowd here. Let's go and give them something to cheer about. And with City, there doesn't seem to be that. There seems to be a little bit of a disconnect, I think, between them and the fans.
I was going to just sort of expand on that and push towards that. What hasn't happened for City this season is whether it's to do with the support base, whether it's to do with the nature of how the games have played out. For instance, both in the home games against Chelsea and Spurs, for a long period of both of those games, they're significantly the better side, Manchester City, but they don't find a way to see it home in either game. Get defeated by Chelsea, which probably ends up being a turning point of the whole season for Chelsea and therefore for the title, and end up being pegged back by Spurs. So when they cut loose City in those games this season, and I think those two, City and Liverpool, are the four best teams in the country as far as I'm concerned. So when it's happened for them this season, City, they've cut loose impressively, but it's seeing it home. And that's the question, really, I think, for this one at the weekend, is if City can get playing and keep playing, if Liverpool do allow them to start playing at some point in the game, whether at the start or the end, Rob, it's whether or not City can get the job done whilst they're on top.
Yeah, they seem to have more mental fragility than ever, don't they, City? You know, I thought they tore Chelsea apart in that game. It is the defining game of this season, I think, that. And the defining moment, to be fair, Neil, to count, they do finish Chelsea off, but for the quirk of fate of De Bruyne's tapping, hitting the top of the crossbar. It goes in, and I think Chelsea are broken then. Chelsea looked for the first time I'd seen since the early part of that season like they were slightly in panic mode. I think that reprieve and the fact that they got that breakaway equaliser changed the course of that game. But you're right, City are failing to kill off teams, but it is to do with their mental fragility. I don't know, I think... On balance, I think Liverpool have to bring our A game. There's no City can bring their B game and find a way to win. I think that's the problem Liverpool have got. Liverpool have, in all the games against the top sides, probably 90% of them brought the A game, and that's seen them through. But it just feels at some stage it's going to be a bridge too far. I just hope it's not this one.
Well, the problem that we have in particular is that if we go through a purple patch the way that Chelsea and Spurs did, we probably do concede more goals because Chelsea and Spurs' defence is a lot better than ours at the moment. So there is that to consider. I personally think, again, I sat here 7 days ago, said the same thing about Burnley. I'm saying it again. It's all about the first 20 minutes. We have to start well. If we can start well in an away game again, cities can start thinking, oh, is this Liverpool has turned up, the one that's really hard for us to beat? And that will start to get in their heads. And the longer we can prolong that feeling, the more we get into the game, the more we get chances, the more we get the chance to put ourselves on the front foot and put them on the back foot.
The way the way both City and Liverpool play, Rob, it strikes me as the sort of game where each of them's very much got the opportunity to play into each other's hands. That's why it's such an intriguing game of football. And that's why still the 1-0 on New Year's Eve remains a surprise, is because they're two sides who you think can both set up in a way to accentuate the strengths of the other and accentuate the weaknesses of each other in equal measure. That if both do play really, really well, there's a fair chance that it doesn't involve either side particularly stopping the other from playing really, really well. Like, for instance, I don't quite understand how City suddenly... I don't know quite what happens that means that City are able to nullify Mane, as an example. Similarly, as an example, I think that there's every chance that whichever side, whichever way City line up, whoever comes up against James Milner could end up giving him a very, very torrid time indeed, although that didn't happen at Anfield and Milner was very impressive on the night. So, but I think in general, what I'm saying is that there is this... If either side click and if both sides click, it is actually quite hard to see how them clicking cancels each other out. If they don't click, they can cancel each other out. And that's what happened on New Year's Eve.
Yeah.
Combined with Liverpool scoring.
It is, except there's one strange thing about this Liverpool side, Neil. I don't think we've had some bad results, God knows. But not many teams have given us a torrid time. We've had a period in a game when Bournemouth come back at us. But Liverpool have been very, very dominant in virtually every single fixture. I'm struggling to think... We think back to the Swansea game at Anfield. They find a way. But those are probably their only three chances in the entire game. Teams are very, very ruthless against Liverpool. City have the ability to be the team that gives Liverpool this torrid time, that can cut loose and get at us down the flanks. But I'm not sure... It's become a given, isn't it, that Liverpool are fragile in defence. But it's still the fact of that fragility is still that it's mainly an aerial problem. When teams go long and put the ball somewhere between the centre-halves and Simon Mignolet, all panic ensues. And it's become a cliche, but it's still right. I don't see that people have played football around, played triangles and got through that defence. You know, fragile as at times they look, an individual error as there seems to be in every single one of our centre-halves. I don't see that many teams have exploited that. So it's going to be interesting to see if City are to beat Liverpool. They will be perhaps the first team that does it by playing football through Liverpool.
Rebecca, slightly resistible force meets object that's been broadly speaking immovable but has moved occasionally so far this season at Manchester City against Liverpool. You would think Liverpool can't keep getting results in these games. That's just, that's a quirk. That at some point there's some sort of reversion to some sort of mean. That said, Liverpool are able to look at themselves and say, well, we've got the pedigree in these games, and that the players also quite clearly believe and buy into everything the manager thinks and says in these games. So it's one of them, really, where whether or not the belief can't run out. Liverpool, for instance, went to Old Trafford and were arguably the better side, deserved to get out with all 3 points when United were on fire and Liverpool had looked poor. It's going to be a strange game, hopefully a very good one.
It's funny, isn't it? Because when we talk about mental fragility, and I think we've touched on it actually throughout the whole time we've been speaking today for various teams on and off, if you look at Man City's mental fragility and Liverpool's mental fragility, they're actually complete opposites. So Liverpool are actually fragile against the weaker sides in the league, and whether it's a lapse in concentration or it's become this season, they're like, God, we're going to concede. Oh, God, a goal's gone in. We're not going to win. Switch-offs against Swansea, switch-offs against Burnley. Right at the start of the season, the Burnley game, not obviously this time round. Bournemouth, these are games that are costing you the title, hopefully not for yourselves and my husband's sanity, a place in the top four. Man City are completely the other way around. They tend to dispatch quite clinically the what I would call dregs of the league, and that's no disrespect whatsoever. What I mean is, you look at City when they play those kind of sides and you think, if they get the first goal, they're going to go on and batter them, because mentally they're like, we're going to do this. But then they'll play a top side and they'll capitulate, that, goals ahead against a couple of the top sides and still capitulated. So I think that is a mental thing, and it does go back to their defence. They do not trust that defence. So the attack will sometimes, especially the midfield, maybe not pass the ball forward. They'll pass it sideways and back because they're like, God, if we lose the ball around sort of Sterling and then they come at the flanks on our defence, we have got big problems. So I think it is going to be such an interesting game to see. And I think going forward, looking at those sides, because neither are winning the title this year, obviously, it is the top four race that both are focusing on. But going forward, it's going to be interesting to see if either of them can shake their so-called mental fragilities, because otherwise next season, neither of them are going to win the title again.
I think the part of the problem we're going to have is we're going to be going for the same players, because fullbacks are massive in Pep's world. And I think we're going to need one. Centre midfield again.
I don't think Liverpool manager cares about spending money on fullback, Mo. I'm going to lash that out there.
Really?
I don't think he cares about the idea he's going to spend. He's put James Milner there. That lad's not spending money on fullbacks. He might get a young lad. He's not going to be committing for a 25 million left back.
I'm hopeful that he's going to see the error of that particular way over the course of the season.
I don't think he is, Mo. I think he's very, very focused on being Jurgen Klopp.
I'm not talking fullbacks. Can I tell you what I think is going to define this game? I think the context of the game is bigger than Liverpool want it to be. In a way, we're back where we were with Leicester.
The idea to bounce back.
Well, yeah, with Leicester, we were either going to benefit from the post-Ranieri depression or we were going to be up against a force that's time had come. And I think this Monaco thing has shell-shocked Manchester City, and they have to react or they will crumble again. And I think that is the biggest factor. Of course, Klopp will prepare Liverpool to bring out A game, but if City decide that they are going to bring their top level because they're so hurt, I think it'll be very, very difficult for us. But they may be too broken.
Liverpool have scored more goals than any other side between 16 and 30 minutes and between 61 and 75 minutes so far this season. We keep saying the first 20 minutes is the most important part. It might be the middle part of each half that becomes the most important part, certainly if Manchester City might be relatively tired. Quickly, before I get for predictions, Rob Gutman, Liverpool need to probably bring two or three of the lads who are injured back.
Who are we talking about? Roberto Firmino.
Firmino, Lovren and Henderson. They could probably do with getting at least two of them on the pitch.
I think there's no chance of Henderson being fit. Firmino has come back to light training. Yeah, Liverpool do. I mean, the worry for Liverpool is Divock Origi just needs another 10 games to refind himself. We don't have the time for that. Coutinho has got...
season's finished.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. It'd
be awful if he's great in game 39. I know,
this is my point.
Yeah, exactly.
Coutinho has disappeared up his own Coutinho-ness in the last few games. It's really worrying, and I think he might be carrying some sort of knock. There's almost a part of me that thinks if Firmino doesn't make the cut, that I'd rather stick young Ben Woodburn in ahead of Origi in the cauldron that isn't the Etihad. I just think he's got something about him. He'd showed something, a substitute. Would Klopp be that crazy? I don't know.
It's a massive kick in the teeth if you are Origi.
Yeah.
Thinking about managing the idea of Origi. He could do with being better at football, I don't disagree.
But I think that Klopp's the kind of guy who will say to him, look, you have been not at your best so far, but this is a chance to turn around one big game, one big performance.
And also, they don't like pace, these lads. For instance, that's what you're saying to him. They're not great in the air and they don't like pace. You're not great in the air either, but you're dead fast.
He's been out of form, but if you think about top-level Origi, if you think about last season's Derby Origi, even first half against Bournemouth Origi, he frightens the life out of Man City. I think he's got to play.
Okay. Imagine being a defence that isn't good in the air or on the floor. My God.
It's quite a strange thing. We've got our weaknesses, but they managed to nail that. They're again, yeah. Quickly, very quickly indeed. Predictions, Rob?
1-0 Liverpool.
Mo?
2-2.
3-2 Liverpool.
3-2 Liverpool. Good Lord, what a game. What an afternoon.
Nil-nil.
Arsenal go to West Brom and Spurs face Southampton. Both interesting games, Rebecca, but both should... I would expect both to get results. I think West Brom have hit 40 points and gone, this is us. And I think it's almost perfect. If Arsenal had to go anywhere, I think that this one's almost perfect, 12:30 Saturday.
I think... Who's going to bother to get up for Arsenal, West Brom? I think in terms of Arsenal, they are just... They're so predictable. Each year, it's every single year we go through the same cycle. They are the ultimate meme. They may as well charge to be a meme generator because... Everybody just laughs at them. We all know what they're going to do. Their start of the season is the same. Win a couple of no-mark things in pre-season. Everything's great. This is a sign a player that isn't actually world-class. I think it's world-class. It's probably another number 10 because you can never have too many number 10s. That's shoes, Wenger. That's shoes. And then, you know, you get to, like, February... And then they're getting more and more injuries. The fans are revolting. The little placards that they've recycled for the last 5 years are coming up. I'm Chelsea, I'm laminated banter, so I can't call anybody. But, you know, their placards come back out. Then they get knocked out of Europe. Then it's will Wenger go. Then it's contract issues. Then it's, they've got to play the dregs of the league to get into the top four. It's this epitome of a cycle. I don't doubt they'll probably beat West Brom because it's the standard Arsenal mantra, unfortunately. If I was an Arsenal fan, I would be wanting more. I probably would be humiliating myself on national TV because I would be so angry.
Aren't they picking up some injuries quietly here? Although I would back them. I think Oxlade-Chamberlain is out. I think Danny Welbeck's not quite right. Mm. So I'm not sure.
Is Danny Welbeck ever quite right?
Well, Rob likes him. Rob likes him.
I put him in my fantasy league team, so I'm invested in Danny Welbeck. I like a dink. He does like a dink. He does a finish like Kenny Dalglish in the 1978 European Cup final. I've never quite got over that finish.
So anyone who does that straight away,
he's my kind of guy.
Path to your heart.
He did it in the Bernabeu, and the keeper just catched it. Not quite as good.
The keeper just stands up and goes, just dink it, I'll catch it.
Can you see? Can anyone? I mean, can you see it being a draw?
Yeah, I can definitely see it being a draw to the 77th minute, and then Arsenal scrambling one over.
Giroud, who's the underrated Giroud who loves this sort of game. I can see that one happening. Okay, elsewhere, Middlesbrough entertain Manchester United, currently with Steve Agnew in charge. Karanka's gone. I had a chat to Hayley McQueen, and I started off the chat by talking about the fact that she supports both teams and how strange that is. Joined now by Hayley McQueen, and the news person in me says, oh, you should be talking about Karanka first, but I'm not. I'm going to stick to my original plan. Which was to ask Hayley about a lot of people support two sides, but normally when you support two sides, it's quite difficult for the two sides to meet. Either they play in different countries or there's leagues of difference between them. Whereas, you know, for obvious reasons, there's two sides that you've got genuine affection for. Your father played football for one of them for some time, and you're from Middlesbrough or the surrounding area of Middlesbrough. So how does it feel when these two teams play each other?
It's really weird. And as you kind of mentioned, there's not that many people that support two teams, especially when they're both in the same league. For a while it was easy because you had Middlesbrough in the Championship and Manchester United in the Premier League. You normally have someone, I don't know, who might support Manchester United but has a bit of a love for, say, Rochdale or Bury or one of the smaller teams from there. So it is kind of weird, but I mean, I was born in Manchester, so when people ask me why I'm a Manchester United fan, I don't have to throw in my dad and sound like, it always sounds like you're showing off a bit, doesn't it? Well, my dad happens to play for them. If they don't know, I'm like, well, I was born and brought up in Manchester. And then, of course, I moved to Teesside when my dad took the job working alongside Brian Robson. They'd always said when they played together that when one of them first got a big job in management or coaching, that the other would go with them. So that's what happened with Brian. My dad had the chance to go to West Brom with him as well, but thank God he didn't do that, because I'd have another team that I might have to have an affiliation with. I was schooled in Teesside. I moved there when I was 14, 15 years old, and that's where I class as home. My family still live there, and I understand how important football is to the area, particularly with it being such a small town as well. It's not a city. It's not massive, and people are very passionate. We've got great derbies, although people would argue that they're not derbies when they're Sunderland and Newcastle. But to us, it's a little bit different as a family when your parents have been involved in a club.
So when the fixture happens, do you find yourself almost context decides who you want to win?
Yeah.
So at the minute, I'm going to put you on the spot and say I'm going to guess that if we're recording this before United's Europa League game, it's important to point it out.
Exactly.
So I'm going to guess that if United go through in the Europa League, you're going to want Middlesbrough to win.
Yeah, and I still have, that's my alarm clock going off to tell me that you were going to ring me. There you go.
Early for once.
I'm desperate for Manchester United to finish in the top four. I still think they will, and I wouldn't like to think that a Middlesbrough win over Manchester United will stop United from doing that, but Middlesbrough need it more. They need the boost. Imagine getting a win over Manchester United, what that would do for them for the rest of the season. I think Sunderland are the only team of those bottom sides struggling that haven't changed their manager, and look where they are. They are rock bottom. Everybody else who's had a change of manager have had a bit of an upturn in form. Even if they're not doing anything differently on the pitch, just your mindset's changed. We've seen how it's happened with Leicester, whether you agree with the Ranieri sacking or not. I'm kind of hoping a little something like that will happen. And if Man United lose, maybe for once it won't be the end of the world. And if that means that it can help Middlesbrough towards the end of the season and stay in the Premier League, then I can deal with that.
So let's get on to the news then, which is that Karanka's gone. Yeah. 3.5 years at the club, and he's done, you know, a creditable job there, got them out. Unlucky first season, got them out, got them up last season, and it's just not quite, it's all about the goals, isn't it? It's about the fact that the football's been joyless, but if it was joyless and it was successful, then you get to shrug your shoulders and say, well, this is our path to 40 points. But when it's joyless and unsuccessful, it's been pretty miserable fare.
Yeah, and it's not just the fact that they can't score goals, it's their defence that was so strong for them in the Championship. It's just really struggling to cope. There have been so many issues as well within the club, arguments, fallout. Obviously, Karanka is a feisty Spaniard, so you're maybe always going to get that. And I thought, okay, I can handle Middlesbrough not being up there as one of the top scoring teams. I could even handle them being the lowest scoring team if they can keep some clean sheets. But, you know, the reality is they need goals now to stay up, and the defence isn't going to help them stay up. I mean, 19 goals from 27 games is just, it's bad, isn't it?
It's really bad, and it's interesting. Steve Agnew's in charge. Looks like he'll be in charge for the weekend, and then the timing of it's easy to say, well, you could have just waited until after the international break. But if they're sort of thinking, well, we could get a mini bounce at the weekend, and then get a further bounce sort of when we bring the new guy in, and also it starts the process obviously of looking for the new guy as well. And I think also the other thing to point out is that Steve Gibson's, he's very much an honourable football man, Steve Gibson. So I suspect even if he's put feelers out, if there is actually somebody semi-lined up, there would come a point where if he feels it's going to happen, he wouldn't want to be disrespectful to the incumbent manager. So a lot of that sort of suggests there's a lot in motion at Middlesbrough.
Yeah, no, there is. And I think there's been a lot of pressure that's mounted on Steve Gibson. And as you mentioned, he's very loyal. He's a brilliant chairman, and he tries to go about doing things in the right way. So earlier in the season, you remember when Karanka pretty much walked out of training and didn't take charge of the Charlton game.
Yep.
Steve Gibson sat down with them and they had it out. And yes, there was a bust up at training. I know that for a fact. And there's been arguments with Stuart Downing and a few of the other players. And should he have been playing Patrick Bamford and Jordan Rhodes? Should he have been doing better under him? Should he have given him a chance? And they were all kind of arguing, but the chairman managed to actually sit down with him face to face, which again is a rare thing in football, and sort it out. And I think potentially what has maybe happened this time around, as the papers reported in the morning of his dismissal, which was by mutual consent, I think they all got it right when they said this was the game that was going to make or break Middlesbrough's season. And how can you put that pressure on a manager when it's Manchester United and it's Jose Mourinho, his mentor for so many years? And I think Karanka was probably told, you need to start picking up results, and we're starting this weekend, regardless of what team it is, whoever the opposition, we need to start picking up points. And he's probably thought he can't see maybe the side picking up points against Manchester United. It's really sad. I hate it when it happens before a game. I'd rather it be on a discussion had after a match, after another disappointing result on a Sunday, maybe the news announced on a Monday, and then, you know, there's not too much upset in the camp building up to a huge game at the weekend.
But the other side of this, which does strike me again, is looking ahead, looking beyond the United game, which is massive. There is the international break, which allows some time. But then the next three are fascinating, I think. They're the three that'll define. And I think this is what's brought it to a head. Swansea home, Hull City home, Burnley away. They're absolutely... Sorry, I've got them all the wrong way around. Swansea away, Hull City away.
Swansea and Hull away,
And Burnley at home. That they're the three that will effectively, you know, if Middlesbrough got 9 points out of that, they'll be in a great position to stay up. If they get if they get 0 points out of that, then they'll almost certainly go down. And that's probably why Gibson's felt he's got to make the big call that he's made.
Yeah, and not only that, so you have these teams who are battling for their own survival. They then take on Arsenal, Man City, Chelsea, and they will play Liverpool on the final day of the season. I mean, my God. Imagine having to go to Anfield, knowing that you need a point at Anfield to rescue your season. Oh.
Well, on a personal point of view, I hope that it's sorted out for you one way or another before then. I'm not going to take a side, one way or the other. So that's the Middlesbrough side, and the Middlesbrough side is that getting the players together and getting them moving. United, off the back of the Chelsea game, there's obviously the Rostov game, which hasn't taken place yet, but they themselves, 12 o'clock, relatively early kickoff on Sunday, they need to, you know, the pressure that the Bournemouth result puts on Manchester United, they obviously need to start picking the wins up as well.
Yeah.
And who knows what kind of Middlesbrough they're going to be up against now with Steve Agnew in charge. I think it's a really tough one for Mourinho this week, just with the tiredness. He's obviously missing key players, strikers. We've had Ibrahimovic suspended. We know that obviously Rooney's not playing, so he's got a little bit of problem up front. I can't see them having any trouble with Middlesbrough's attack. So they're, I think Man United's defence are going to be okay. But the issue that they have is they had this game. Obviously, it was just a straightforward FA Cup game playing Chelsea. No, it wasn't that straightforward. Their plane broke down, didn't it? And they didn't get back until 4:30 in the morning. And that's turning to the training ground where the players' cars were, who then had to drive home to wherever it is that they live, and the manager going back to his hotel. Realistically, they weren't getting back to their houses until 5:30 in the morning, and they had planned a training warm down day that day, and then obviously having to prepare that one day before a European game. Thank God they weren't away in Europe this week, because they really would be struggling. So at least that's at home. But as you mentioned, they've not got much time to turn it around. But you know, luckily Middlesbrough is not too far across the M62. But I think I'll be interested to hear from Mourinho about how tired his squad are this week.
Yeah, and certainly post, it is a nightmarish run. The other thing I'd expect as well, I expected across the board for these sides who are looking for the top four places at least, I expect there's going to be a lot of lads who suddenly can't make this international break right the way across the board. A lot of people are going to have injuries, not just at Manchester United. It wouldn't surprise me if there's a couple of them at Liverpool, Tottenham and Man City as well. Can I ask what the last, before I get you to give me a prediction, can I ask you the last... So let's say United win 3-1. Are you more? Do you get to sort of focus on being happy, or do you instead think, "Oh, are you worried about Middlesbrough? How does it play out? Do you do the sadness bit or do the happy bit?"
No, I think I would be more inclined to feel for Middlesbrough. I think I would be focused too much on that. A draw ideally would be a good result, not for United, but certainly that would be a massive point for Middlesbrough. And they've done, God, they beat Manchester City a few times. You know, they've done okay, not in the cup. But they've pulled off a few shock results.
Good point at Arsenal.
Exactly. They've done, they pick up points against the strangest of opposition, but they've always been a team like that. Okay, not so much this season. They haven't picked up all 3 points at any decent sides. I don't know. It's going to be tough. It's going to be tough either way. I'm luckily not working on Sunday. I'm presenting Stoke Chelsea at the weekend, so I've got the
Sunday off.
Champions in waiting to work on Saturday, and then Sunday. I don't even know if I'm going to watch it.
Of course, you should watch it. Come on, we're strong enough for this.
Yeah. I get really nervous. I've just had my nails done. I don't want to have to bite them all down again.
Give me a prediction.
I'm going to go for 0-0. Middlesbrough aren't going to score against Manchester United. The way that Manchester United are at the moment with their own striker issues, I'm just going to go for a boring 0-0.
0-0 from Hayley McQueen, 50-50 football here. Hope you enjoyed yourself. Let's get back and see what everyone else thinks. Lovely to speak to Hayley as ever. The relegation picture, Mo, what was looking like it might be a rollercoaster ride, has suddenly become really rather dull. Hull look like the only side who have a surge in them, unless there's a new manager bounce from Middlesbrough. And they probably don't look like they've got as much of a surge in them as Palace, Leicester, Swansea. It's a massive game at the weekend, Sunderland versus Burnley. For both sides, still think Burnley could do with getting one more win and just generally get themselves an away win this season with an eye on next. But it doesn't look as though, come May, I think we're not really going to be looking down at the bottom, at the very bottom of the table. You might disagree with me.
No, I think Middlesbrough and Sunderland are pretty, you can pretty much write them off now. I think Hull have got a bit of fight in them. It's whether or not the teams above them get jittery. I think Leicester have probably now got it enough to just ease away. Swansea have got enough quality, but they've got some tough fixtures. And Palace have got some tough fixtures. So I see potentially going down to the wire between Hull and Palace, but I would have to say, hands to heart now, I'd probably say the three there are going to be the three.
Three of the three?
Yeah, I mean, when Paul Clement took over at Swansea, I thought, you know what, actually, outside bet, but I can see them staying up just because he's a good manager, that man. And when you get recommendations from people like Ancelotti, who respect you that much, there's something you're doing right there. I think I completely agree with you. I fully think that Sunderland are gone dead weight. You know, for me, I look at Sean Dyche at Burnley and I kind of think you've actually done probably, arguably, one of the best jobs of managers in recent times. And you're not getting that credit because you're Burnley manager. I personally do not like Burnley at all because I can remember what Ashley Barnes did to Matic, our title-winning season. So I was still not forgiven that. I've still got a grudge against Reading a decade later for Czech. So Leicester, disgracefully, are going to stay up. And I don't think they deserve to because of what the players have done. The players should hang their heads in shame. But, I mean, that question's been discussed, I'm sure, many times. But for the relegation battle now, it's nowhere near what we kind of thought it was going to be, isn't
it? Was looking really good for a while.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's become battle of the new manager bounce, hasn't it? Yeah. I think I said the other week.
When's he going to play his joker?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you almost wonder, is it three games to go? Sunderland are going to go, we're sacking you, Moisey. I'm sorry.
Because we need nine.
Definitely win the last three and that might just...
There's no derby against Newcastle, though, is there? So
we've got to be heading towards some sort of record of sackings in the bottom six. Well, it feels like it anyway.
It's all of them now, bar Moise.
Yeah.
It's five of the bottom
and then
six.
Then there was Moisey.
Moisey's seeing it through to the bitter end.
They'd rather go down with Moisey.
But yep. The thing is, though, I think it seems ridiculous to us, but if they're genuinely thinking long-term, like Ellis Short was saying at the beginning of the season, Moyes has been the man I've been after the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
He's genuinely thinking long-term. He's thinking this guy is going to be able to get us back up. What we've just said about Sean Dyche, a lot of the teams who do come back up with the same guy do a lot better the second time around.
Because
the managers learn as well as the players squad.
You might be right, Mal.
It's still Moyes. We obviously have to give that.
He doesn't know the championship, though, does he? That would be my only thing. The championship is a harder league than people think to get out of.
Was he Preston?
He was, but
I suppose,
a lot different life.
A long time ago. Many years back.
And he hasn't had his own team of yard dogs yet to put together. He's had to work with somebody else's yard dogs.
He's just buying Everton 05, isn't he? It's like, are they available?
Yeah, they are sort of his lads in a few senses. Packs his lunch in a sunblessed bag. The children call them Moisey. All right, what have we got next? They're the ones of the weekend. I say Sunderland versus Burnley is massive. It's a huge game. It'll be a good game as well. Burnley are a decent side. It's whether or not they can put it together for 90 minutes against Sunderland. I was impressed with them at Anfield last weekend. But Palace, it's huge for Palace because the fixtures that come up aren't the nicest. They could very much do with getting 3 points on the board against Watford this week. So I spoke to Robbie Scotcher and he thinks they're going to, but then Robbie always does. And joined now from a central London bar by Robbie Scotcher to talk about Crystal Palace. Pretty exciting to have Robbie on to talk about Palace. And it's another massive game down there at the bottom for you this weekend, Robbie. 3 points would make a profound difference, I suspect, at this stage of proceedings. At home against Watford, it's one that really, really should be getting targeted, shouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, this holds. It's quite an interesting one, this, because number one, I sit next to a Watford fan at work. So, I mean, that could ruin my whole week if we don't get a result.
Yep.
Second, it's always possibly the worst game of football you will ever watch. If you've ever seen a Palace-Watford game, if there's an advert for the worst type of football in the Championship, it's that game. Literally, it is awful.
Why is it so bad?
But we do need to win it. We need to win it. And you know what? I think we're going to.
But why is it so bad, just out of interest? What is it about that game that's just... Do both sides just bring the worst out in each other or something?
It's just... Every time you watch it, I mean, I've got no hope for it at all. It's normally low scoring. It's just two teams who just forget how to play football. They kind of just run into each other. It's just an awful game of football. But saying that, you know, people's football still love it.
Indeed, but you know, I mean, the strange thing about this is that I had a little look at the table today, and I'm in the strange situation now where I think that there's the three who are above the bottom three, Leicester, Swansea, and Palace. I'm looking at them, and I think that they could all conceivably finish this season ahead of Burnley, Watford, and Bournemouth. Where, you know, if you actually beat Watford, you're only then 3 points behind them. So by sort of the logical knock-on of this, at the minute Crystal Palace are in a relegation battle. If they beat Watford, they could finish ahead of Watford. Are Watford in a relegation battle? It's sort of where I end up along those lines. Now, I don't think Watford are in a relegation battle. They've got 10 games, 11 games left within which if they just win two of them and pick up a couple of draws, they should be absolutely fine. But it is sort of, I think it tells you a lot about sort of Palace's season, the potential of the players that they've got, that even though it's been about as bad as you could imagine it could be, there's still every chance that at the end of the season, me and you are having a chat and you've come 12th.
Yeah, I mean, it's just weird. It's made no sense this whole season, the players we've got and what's going on. I think there's so much gone behind the scenes at Palace this year. I think there's been a lot of transition, a lot of trying to be a better team, play a better football, brought in better players, but the club doesn't have that ethos. It's just, and you look at all the teams down there, I think we're going to be all right. I think we're going to come out of it. I think Sacco's huge. I think Benteke is absolutely coiled spring. I think we're going to get out of it, but you know, you just don't know. It's been one of the most, as a Palace fan, one of the most random seasons you can ever imagine, because it was like, it was full of hope. Absolutely full of hope at the start of the season. You were looking at it going, look what we've got. We've got Kabay, we've got all these great players. And then just couldn't have, I don't know why, nothing gelled, nothing worked. It's just been random. I mean, even we brought Mandanda, the keeper, come in. He's a great keeper. He hasn't played. He's fit. He's fit and he's not playing because he doesn't want to be there. He wants to go. It's just, there's a lot of weird, random things happening behind the scenes and stuff. I just hope we stay up and then we just clear it all out.
Yeah, it is a strange situation. It's a few sides of our odd seasons, and I think you're sort of surrounded by those other ones. But the other marker for me on this, and I think this stuff matters, I think that there's the odd anomaly, but I refuse to believe there's two or three, is the goal difference. Palace's goal difference, for instance, is better than Watford's. It's better than everybody in the bottom. It's either level two or better than everybody else from 11th down, which suggests, again, that there's not... that even though there's been a few defeats, for instance, the terrible defeat against Sunderland this season, that Palace aren't absolutely, you know, dreadful or woeful or anything like that. But this weekend's game's huge. If you were to lose it, and suddenly you find yourselves then 9 points behind Watford, and either of Hull or Middlesbrough get something from their games, then you would really be looking at the long haul then of a dogfight, given the fact that your next three are Chelsea away, Southampton away, and Arsenal at home.
Yeah. I mean, you can. I tell you what. Could there be any more noise right now in London? Sorry. I thought I found. Just so you know, I was in hospital this morning. I fractured my hand, and I left early after X-ray to come and talk to you. I couldn't find the quietest spot in the whole of London. Totally. And I think losing 1-0 to Sunderland would have been a disaster. Losing 4-0 to Sunderland was great. I know that sounds really stupid, but it was like, come on, wake up. You guys are rubbish. You need to really sort it out. But right now, down there, it's not finished. The twists and turns aren't done. We're nowhere near finding out what's going to happen at the end of this season. It is literally going to be... I mean, Hull look a lot better than you'd ever imagine Hull will ever look as a football team. There's so many things going to happen yet on this. And yeah, we do need to beat Watford. Watford are sitting there... They're not doing anything. They don't have to win. They're not going to be dragged into it, really. Their season's kind of done. But that's the worst time to play some teams sometimes. Teams with no ambition that are going to just sit back and just be boring and then grind out a 1-0 win against you. And, I hope we don't lose, because that's a whole week of him just showing me the goals. Every single break, every second I'm going to listen to it. Talk about Graham Taylor. It's just hell. We just need this win. I can't hear you guys very well, but can I just... wanted to say one thing.
Go on.
I'm a very, very close mate of mine who's a Red. He's from Liverpool. I've known him for years. I mean, he's a staunch Liverpool supporter. He's campaigned with Hillsborough. He was there on the day and everything like that. His son, he's six, has got trials for Liverpool.
Congratulations to him.
I don't want to give him a shout-out because I don't want to say his name, but if you ever in, 15 years' time hear of Sonny Liverpool captain, it's going to be this lad.
Okay. I like all that sort of talk, Robbie. Robbie, quick then, because you can't hear me that well and I'm shouting. Give me your prediction, your scoreline prediction for Palace Watford.
I reckon that people won't even know the result because they'll be asleep by the end of it. But if anyone turns on, sports, whatever, and has a look, you're going to see Palace are going to win 2-0. Benteke's going to score one. Townsend's going to get the other. And Benteke's going to score a penalty this time. We put his foot through it straight for the back of the net.
Excellent stuff. Always great to speak to Robbie. And we'll have a chat now about the rest of the relegation picture. Always good to speak to Robbie. Rob, do you also think the bottom three is the bottom three?
Yes, it looks pretty much set. I don't know, there's still 10 games. The thing that annoys me most when people go is, I think there's another twist in this one. And it usually affects us, and we never get the twist.
never twist
ever,
in our favour,
never
please.
Never ever have we had the twist coming in our favour that I can remember. Not in
there's another twist in this one.
There's another twist.
I wonder if there might be a little twist.
I think the one thing
in Hall away at Everton.
The reason you get a twist at the bottom is you've got the fate of six teams there, probably. So one of them's going to do something slightly surprising. So there will be a bloody twist.
Well, so far,
always is.
The twist has been getting points from Liverpool because Hull beat us, Swansea beat us, Leicester beat us, Sunderland got Robin a draw, Hood. And we've got to play Palace. So maybe that's your twist.
But us against Palace would best not be the twist, Mo. I could strongly do without that. But
Columbus
sure, best
that, to be honest.
No, it's a Sunday kickoff that, and I'm not having my whole weekend ruined by Palace. I'm not open. I'm not open for that in any way, shape, or form. All right, then. We've worked through every single Premier League game. Well done, us, broadly speaking. As I say, I do wonder whether or not Hull might surprise people at Goodison, a slightly grumpy Goodison Park around the Lukaku saga. Very well timed that, well in, lad. Very well timed indeed. But anyway, been a pleasure to speak to Rob and Mo and Rebecca this week, and huge thank you as well to Tom, David, Haley, and Robbie Scotcher. It's been our 50-50 football show. Do be telling your friends here every single week, Thursdays and Mondays. See you in a bit.